final investigator I met with was Dr. Martin Reck. To begin our conversation, he commented on new drugs in development, beginning with the tyrosine kinase inhibitor he studied, VIBF-1120.
This is an oral VEGF-TKA. So this is an anti-angiogenic drug. So from the mode of action, it is a little bit comparable to bevacizumab. Bevacizumab is a direct inhibitor of VEGF, and VIBF-1120 is a direct inhibitor of the VEGF receptor. And besides this, VIBF-1120 is also an inhibitor of PDGF and FGF receptor. So it's inhibiting all crucial structures which are responsible for angiogenesis. And we have performed a phase 2 trial, and we will present phase 3 data in autumn this year in a second-line trial where we combine docetaxel with VIBF-1120.
And what are you seeing at this point?
Well, we have closed the database, and we will have the final data by mid of the year. So what we can say, we had 2 interim analyses for futility, and we got the recommendation from the DMC to go on with the trial. So up to now, we haven't seen futility of the trial. We haven't seen any severe safety risks associated with the treatment with VIBF. So we were able to fully recruit the trial. And that's the data that I can say by today. And we will have the full data by September this year.
And do you see anti-angiogenic-like side effects like hypertension and nosebleeds?
Yeah, we did see some hypertension. We also did see minimal increase in proteinuria, but there was not a severe or significant increase in bleeding events, especially in hemoptysis. So in contrast to bevacizumab with VIBF-1120, we included all histologies, not only non-squamous non-small cell lung cancer, we also included patients with squamous cell histology who are excluded from treatment with bevacizumab, and we didn't see any increase in severe bleeding events in this group of patients.
As long as you brought that up, what's your current thinking about the mechanism of why hemoptysis was seen with bevacizumab, particularly with squamous cell?
I think the original data for these findings came out of phase 2 trials, and these were 6 patients with squamous cell carcinoma in the Johnson trial, which were the reason to exclude all patients with squamous cell carcinoma from further treatment with bevacizumab. My personal belief is that this association of histology and increase of bleeding events is not related to histology. I do believe that this histology is more a surrogate marker of several factors coming together. Central tumor location, invasion of surrounding vessels, and maybe beyond this also some factors which might be contributed by histology. But histology as histology is not the driving factor for an increased risk of hemoptysis.
It's been always kind of tough for me to get a grasp on it. Do you think it occurs in patients who are responding? Is it part of a response or a toxicity?
It's part of a vascular interaction. We didn't see this event. So first of all, the event of severe pulmonary hemorrhage by bevacizumab is a rare event. So we have data now from nearly 4,000 patients who were treated in the ARIES and in the SAIL trial. And in both of these trials, the incidence of severe pulmonary hemorrhage was below 1%. So it's very difficult to sort out these patients who will suffer from this severe vascular-associated event. But we didn't see any disbalance between patients who had responded to bevacizumab or patients who had not responded to bevacizumab. And I think this is a mixture, and the risk for pulmonary hemorrhage may be predicted by the structure of the tumor with the vessel infiltration. And I personally also do believe that that necrosis of the tumor, the central necrosis of the tumor, like we do see in patients with cavernizations inside the pulmonary carcinomas, also might be a contributing factor to this event of pulmonary hemorrhage.
So does that mean you'll consider using bevacizumab in squamous cell cancer if it's not a large central lesion?
No.
Not that brave, huh?
No. We have some exploratory trials, and they showed a manageable safety, and they showed a moderate number of patients with pulmonary hemorrhages. However, up to now, I would strongly recommend to stick to the label, to use it only in non-squamous cell histologies.
Getting back to anti-angiogenic TKIs, do you see a future for that strategy?
The problem is that the whole story of VEGF TKIs is under discussion in lung cancer, because up to now, we do not have a clear positive randomized phase 3 trial supporting the use of the VEGF TKIs in lung cancer. The specific nature of BIBF-1120 is the fact that this is a drug with a high inhibiting activity on the key angiogenesis mediating structures, PDGF, VEGF, and FGF. And this is in contrast to all the other multikinase inhibitors. So, for example, sunitinib has some activity on VEGF and PDGF, but not on FGF. And so there might be a difference based on the molecular structure of this drug, but we have to wait for the phase 3 data.
What about immune strategies in lung cancer? I see you have a poster here looking at messenger RNA vaccination. You were involved with the data presented last year in ipilimumab that Tom Lynch presented. Any of that or anything you want to comment on in terms of that kind of strategy?
I think this is another approach. We do know that all tumors, and for sure also lung cancer, do have some relations with the immune systems. And the rationale for using immune therapy is very broad based on preclinical data. However, up to now, we do not have very supporting clinical data to do this. And there are several strategies. So, number one, ipilimumab, this is an anti-CTLA-4 antibody, which enables the cellular-mediated immune reactions against a variety of tumor. This was one of the first trials which was positive in combination with chemotherapy in advanced patients, in patients with advanced lung cancers of all histologies, non-small cell and small cell lung cancer. So we got a positive result in progression-free survival for one of the regimen which we used. And this was the rationale to go forward, to design a phase 3 trial, which is now coming up, for a combination of chemotherapy plus or minus ipilimumab. So we have a signal generated in a phase 2 trial. We are going to validate the signal in a phase 3 trial. We have some other trials going on in lung cancer, and most of them are using this immune therapy in minimal residual diseases. So, for example, there is this MAGE-A3 vaccine, which is now being tested in the adjuvant setting. And this is quite a clever idea, because I personally do believe if immune therapy does work in lung cancer, it does work in the most minimal residual status of disease that you can achieve. And this is the adjuvant situation. So currently we have this big randomized phase 3 trial testing MAGE-A3 vaccine in operated patients, and they are really going straight forward in the recruitment and the trial, and we do expect the finalization of recruitment by end of the year.
What about the BLP vaccine? What does that look at?
Yeah, we have some signals coming out from randomized phase 2 trials, and this is now also in a phase 3 trial. And they are looking not for the minimal residual disease for the adjuvant setting. They are looking for stage 3 patients after chemoradiotherapy. And they try to use this immune therapy as a kind of disease stabilization or maintenance treatment.
What is it actually vaccinating against?
This is a CMAC vaccine. And this is also something which is overexpressed in non-small cell lung cancer.
And any toxicities with it?
It has been discussed whether there have been some central nervous side effects associated with this drug. However, the data were not conclusive, and in the end, the DMC decided to go on with the recruitment of the trial, so it's further recruiting.
What are the different ways that the vaccines are made? For example, this RNA thing that you're reporting here, how is it actually made?
I think this RNA thing, this is a very specific approach, and this is a very early vaccine that we are presenting. Normally, we have either vaccines derived of non-small cell tumor cell lines, so this is the Lucanix drug, or we have peptides that we are using, or we use antibodies like ipilimumab. And this RNA, this is really a new approach to use tumor-specific RNA for vaccination. So in this trial, we used tumor RNA from 5 tumor-related antigens as a stimulus for immune boost. And this is more a proof of concept. So we do not have real clinical data. We do not have no clinical efficacy data. This is more a proof of concept to show the ability of this vaccine to activate the immune system.
Okay, let's talk about the cases you were going to talk about, beginning with your 44-year-old woman.
I think this is one of the new patients that we do see. We do see more and more frequently this never-smoking young female patients coming with an adenocarcinoma. And the reason for her to go to the GP were pain in her back. So this was not a thoracic syndrome. She didn't suffer from dyspnea or from thoracic pain or any other thoracic symptoms. She did suffer from pain in the back. And she came with a stage 4 disease lung cancer with a diffuse bone metastasis, and she had a mass in the right upper lobe and a diffuse mediastinal lymph node infiltration. And we were able to make the diagnosis of an adenocarcinoma. This was a TTF1 positive adenocarcinoma. However, this is one of the problems in lung cancer, that you not always are able to get an histological sample out of this tumor. This was done by a biopsy of the bone metastasis, and there we were able to detect a exon 19 mutation of the EGF receptor.
Which bone did you biopsy?
The spine was biopsied. And then in Europe, we have gefitinib license for mutation-positive tumors. So this patient received gefitinib. We did see a rapid remission, and this is one of the clinical advantages of this treatment in the mutation-positive tumors. When this drug works, you see within 4 weeks a dramatic response of the tumor. So we have seen response rates between 70 and 85% and mutation-positive tumors treated with an EGF receptor TKA.
Her pain got better?
Yeah. In the time of 4 to 6 weeks, she really had a dramatic reduction of her energetic drug medication.
How about side effects? Any skin problems?
Yes. Skin. She had got a rash grade 2, but we were able to treat her with topical steroids, with topical emulsions, and we had one period of systemic antibiotics, doxycycline, and this worked very well. And also the side effect of rash, this is a very dynamic side effect. So you have periods of very heavy rash, but it also will disappear after a certain period of time, after a number of weeks. So in average, the skin tolerability of the treatment with gefitinib was fine.
You published a paper in Oncology about this issue. Do you use preemptive therapy? We've chatted with Mario Lacouture, who's at Memorial now, who is a strong believer in that. Or do you wait for people to have symptoms?
No. I start with a topical treatment from the first day of treatment with an EGF receptor TKA. So all of my patients receive the advice to use topical emulsions, and they receive a prescription for topical steroids from myself, and all of them receive the strong advice to use sun blockers and sunglasses if they do have an exposition to sun.
How about oral antibiotics?
No, this really I only would use if there is a clinical sign of rash.
I'm kind of curious, before you go on with her story, what her personal reaction was. You know, the patient sounds like she was healthy, non-smoking, all of a sudden presents with advanced lung cancer.
I think she needed 6 weeks to realize her situation. But the problem was she really benefited extremely rapidly from this treatment. So she really got the hope of cure of her disease. And this is very difficult, and this is also a difficult situation if you have a lot of this stage four patients because you have to tell them there will be a day of progress and we have to prepare for this day as well.
What was her life situation? Was she working, family?
She has a family with two kids and she was working. And for, I think, for 2 months, she had to interrupt her job. But then she was able to work again for 10 months.
What kind of work did she do?
She was working in a shop. She was a shop assistant.
So what was the next step? She had this great response. Then what?
So we are very conservative. So we have a very close follow-up of the patient. So we have x-rays every few weeks and we have bone imaging every few weeks. And we really saw a stabilization of this nearly complete response for 12 months. And this was extremely fine. However, in April this year, there was a rapid decrease of the performance status of the patient. There was an increase in pain. And there was also a dramatic deterioration of her general health status. So she really became ill. And what we did see first was an extreme dramatic progression of the bone metastasis. But besides that, we also saw a progression in the liver. We saw new liver mets and we saw new CNS metastasis.
Now, did you look at the tumor again? Did you get more tissue? What do you do in these kinds of situations? Is there any point from a clinical point of view, for example, and I don't know, looking for a T790 mutation or anything biologically like that? Or is that more a research thing?
Yeah. Normally, I think this was a very dramatic development. So we really were in an urgent need to start any salvage treatment. If this would have been a slow progression or a more or less asymptomatic progression, we would have gone for a second biopsy to look for any of these resistant markers, I would say. The problem is that up to now, we do not have any drug available for this T790M mutation, only in clinical trials. There is a compassionate use program now running in Europe using afatinib. So potentially, this patient, if the progression would have been less dramatically, this would have been a potential candidate for treatment with afatinib. However, due to this rapid progression of the disease, we were in need of a very, very spontaneous and very quick treatment. And we started radiation treatment of the CNS metastasis as well as platinum-based chemotherapy of cisplatinum and pemetrexed.
So let's talk about your second patient, the 62-year-old woman.
I think this is also a patient who came to our hospital with symptomatic disease. So this is a patient with a really large central tumor. This was an adenocarcinoma. This was a stage 4 adenocarcinoma with pleural metastasis. We do see pericardial metastasis, and we also did see a symptomatic CNS metastasis. The problem was this was not a really old patient, 62 years old, smoking. We did not have really an information regarding the EGF receptor mutation status. We only had the information that this was an adenocarcinoma, and the task for us was to define the most efficacious first-line treatment which we could offer to the patient. And this was the reason why we decided to give her a chemotherapy combination with bevacizumab, because we did believe, and we have seen in all the clinical trials, that response, and this was the thing which we urgently needed in this patient, that response is increased by the combination of bevacizumab to chemotherapy, and therefore we treated her with 4 cycles of chemotherapy and bevacizumab, and we did see also an extremely good response after 2 cycles of this combination treatment.
Which chemo?
It was a platinum-based chemotherapy, and this patient was treated in a safety trial of bevacizumab, the SAIL trial, and in that trial we were free of choice to use our platinum-based chemotherapy. And due to the reduction of the performance status of the patient, I was a little bit afraid to use cisplatinum. Therefore, I went for a carboplatinum-based regimen, and we chose a combination of carboplatinum and vinorelbine in combination with bevacizumab.
What about the issue of using bevacizumab with CNS meds?
When we started with bevacizumab, there were some cases of central nervous system complications induced by bevacizumab. However, we do now have data from a meta-analysis showing no increase of CNS adverse events by the use of bevacizumab in patients with CNS metastasis. So, for example, the European Registration Authority removed the label restriction on CNS meds by the use of bevacizumab. And I personally have treated, I think, 15 or 20 patients with CNS meds and never saw any CNS event caused by the use of bevacizumab.
We've heard about people who have already had radiation. They've been treated. Was this patient, did she get the radiation first? So are you saying you've had 15 people who had untreated brain meds?
Yeah, they had untreated brain meds. I think this is another point, interesting point, which I discussed with a couple of radiotherapists. Normally, if you have a stage 4 disease with a CNS med, the first action is the irradiation of the CNS meds. And normally we try to intercalate the CNS radiation to the chemotherapy. So we start with chemotherapy and we try to perform CNS radiation therapy between the first and second cycle or between the second and the third cycle. The problem is that you always have to balance the decision where is the biggest need for treatment. If you have a high tumor burden with a lot of metastasis, I do think in a couple of patients, you really are in the need to start with the systemic treatment first and then to think about the CNS radiation therapy if you have a patient with the asymptomatic CNS metastasis.
So this patient actually had objective response in the CNS, the
systemic treatment. Yeah.
Has she gotten radiation?
Yes. Afterwards, she got CNS radiation.
Did you send off EGFR mutation status? What was it? And how do you approach the issue of testing in patients who are smokers?
Well, the problem of this patient was we had some material from a transbronchial biopsy. However, the material was not sufficient to perform the EGF receptor mutation test. This is also a situation which we have from time to time, that we are able to make the diagnosis, but there is not enough sufficient material to perform the sequencing. So therefore, I cannot provide the information regarding the EGF receptor mutation status. Regarding the smoking status, I personally do believe that smoking is not an exclusion criteria for the exclusion of patients from this EGF receptor mutation test, because we do have data from a big screening trial which was performed by the Spanish lung cancer group. And in this setting, of course, most of the patients which did have an EGF receptor mutations were never smokers, but there were, I think, around 20% of the patients who were smokers or at least light smokers who also did have an EGF receptor mutation. So, and this is something we have seen in a variety of clinical trials. So I personally do believe that there is a group of smoking patients who also do have an EGF receptor mutation, and we should also test smoking patients for an EGF receptor mutation.
Only non-squamous in terms of testing?
Yes. I personally would not test a squamous cell carcinoma patient for an EGF receptor mutation.
How did this patient do with the bevacizumab? Any hypertension?
Yes. But we were able to manage this side effect. We put some antihypertensive treatment and she was doing fine.
What's her current situation?
She has now progressed. She's on second line treatment.
With what?
She received pemetrexed, second line.
And how's she doing?
More or less. She has some stabilization, but she has stage 4 disease and she has still a symptomatic stage 4 disease. So we didn't see this dramatic response that we have seen after the first line treatment.
Why don't we talk about your last patient, a 68-year-old man?
Mm-hmm. I think this is the most typical patient that we do see frequently in our office. So this is a male patient, 68 years old, with a couple of comorbidities, vascular comorbidities, cardiac comorbidities, lung comorbidities, moderate COPD. And this patient presented with deterioration of his respiratory symptoms, with increase of cough, with some hemoptysis and dyspnea. And what we did see was a central tumor with a large mediastinal lymph node infiltration, and we were able to perform a histology, which revealed a squamous cell carcinoma, a central squamous cell carcinoma of the lung. And, well, this was a patient which we treated with a platinum-based chemotherapy for 4 cycles. We did see some tumor stabilization, not quite a real tumor response. And we delivered this patient, or we sent this patient after termination of chemotherapy to radiation treatment of the mediastinum.
And what's his current situation? What happened after that? Did he get radiation therapy?
Yes, he received radiation therapy. And he received a further stabilization of his disease. And as far as I do remember, he's still stable in his disease.
And you have down here a question, simultaneous or sequential chemoradiation. Can you comment on that?
I think this is the question which we face every day, because if we look on the data which are available and on the meta-analysis data which are available, all patients with a locally advanced tumor should receive a simultaneous chemoradiotherapy. However, if you are really working in daily life oncology, you see that I would suggest between 30% and 40% of all patients really are suitable for concomitant chemoradiotherapy. And this is something which should be worked out better in clinical trials, because especially in patients with squamous cell carcinoma, we do see a lot of comorbidities. We do see a lot of respiratory comorbidities which might prevent patients from receiving simultaneous chemoradiotherapy. So this is really a point of discussion, which patient might benefit from simultaneous chemoradiotherapy and which patient might receive a large higher decrease of toxicities by this simultaneous treatment approach.
Another question you pose here is cis or carbo.
This is also one question which is a different situation between Europe and the United States, because in Europe we tend more to use this platinum-based regimen. If you look on the meta-analysis data, what we have seen is that for sure response associated with cisplatinum is better. However, there is only a modest increase in overall survival by the use of cisplatinum, and there is a significant increase in toxicity by the combination with cisplatinum. So from my opinion, this is a very individual decision to look on the platinum compound which are you going to use. For example, if I have really a palliative treatment setting with a stage 4 patient, I always would go for a carboplatinum-based chemotherapy regimen.
What about this issue of possibly using post-radiation therapy, systemic therapy, including the possibility of something like erlotinib?
You mean after radiotherapy?
Well, you put down here any indication to switch maintenance. Is that, were you talking about that
this,
after?
This would be the approach after radiotherapy. So if you only see a tumor stabilization and an improvement of tumor stabilization, you really can discuss whether you provide this patient with an early second line treatment or with a switch maintenance treatment with erlotinib, because this would be licensed for the drug. And I think regarding this whole maintenance story, what is really important is to have a close follow-up on all patients. So this is something which we learned, that after frontline chemotherapy, you have to see your patients quite frequently. So when we wrote down our recommendations in our first version, we said, well, if you see your patient every 3 months after primary treatment, that's enough. But we changed this interval to 6 to 8 weeks, because we do believe if there is any progression and if the patient is potentially eligible for any second-line treatment, we would recommend a new treatment for these patients.
Anything new? We hear so much about things in adenocarcinoma. Anything new and exciting in squamous cell? Last year, we saw some data Mark Sosinski presented on nab-paclitaxel. Looked like it had maybe more effect in squamous cell. What were your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I think this was one of the positive trials. I think we have to see some more data regarding this is not a new drug. This is only a new formulation of the drug. What was quite disappointing was this IGF receptor story in squamous cell carcinoma. So we had the negative ficatumumab trial. And up to now, the problem is that there is no drug really working better in squamous cell carcinoma. And I think up to now, there is not a new approach on the screen which might be suitable for squamous cell carcinoma.
Anything at a genomic level that would explain why squamous cell carcinoma seems so resistant to systemic treatment or biologic level?
I think that the problem is that the dynamics and that the development of squamous cell carcinoma is more or less extremely slow, and it's extremely difficult to interfere with this growth of squamous cell carcinoma. And we do not have really this oncogenic-driven tumors among squamous cell carcinoma. All oncogenic alterations that we are aware, let's say EGF receptor mutation, let's say ALK translocation, let's say BRAF, HER2 mutation, are only found in adenocarcinoma. They are not found in squamous cell carcinoma. And I think that's the reason that squamous cell carcinoma really is a chronic malignant disease, which is really difficult to interfere with.